You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Linda Pasto. Did I pronounce it correctly?
You did.
Okay, so Linda, it's good to have you here.
I'm really excited to be here.
So the way the show starts is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live by or your experiences to start this conversation?
Well, my biggest quality or goal in every day is to make a difference. I feel like every day I should make a difference in somebody's life, whether it's just getting somebody to smile while they're standing in line or to have a much bigger impact. And I also like to spread joy every day. So making somebody happy is also part of who I am. And it's been that way for a very long time.
So that is clearly something that someone who has lived a while and worked with a lot of people would aspire to. But you say you've done it for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
So what about you made you the kind of person that would come quickly to?
Well, part of it started, I've moved a lot as a kid. I was born in Chicago. I lived in Oregon for 10 years. My dad did a sabbatical in Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh, so lived there for a year, back to Oregon, then moved to Massachusetts, then moved to New York, and lived in the Syracuse area, and then moved to Ithaca. This is the longest I've lived anywhere. It's been 33 years in Ithaca.
Wow.
So, and when we first moved here, everybody said, so where do you work at Cornell? And I was like, I don't work at Cornell. My husband doesn't work at Cornell. We came for other reasons and sort of fell in love with it here. And there's certainly a feeling of lots of people wanting to make a difference, and it's very contagious. But I was already there, I think, just because that's a great way to meet people is to get involved in things. I was raised in the Unitarian Church. There's certainly a sense of, community and service there. And that was my home church from the time I was 5. So that was also part of the whole process of growing and developing. And it just was, and my parents were that way. My parents were involved in politics and in church, and there was always a sense of giving back to the mm-hmm. community right from the very start. So it just seemed the natural thing to do.
Neat, neat. And what, just out of curiosity, what brought you here that didn't involve Cornell or Ithaca College?
Well, my husband took a job, at Challenge Industries and worked there for about 13 years and then went on to Cornerstone Recovery. I started with a nursing position at Cuca College. Did that for 3 years. The commute got a little old very quickly, 65 miles one way in all sorts of weather. And then a position came open at TC3 in the nursing program, and I was there for 27 years till I retired 4 years ago.
Cool.
So, yep.
So, you brought some music with you. What would you like to open with?
Oh, let's open with Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys,
okay.
Which goes back to my West Coast roots.
Okay, here we go.
I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. Somehow closer now. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. She's by my excitation. Good, good.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Linda Pasto. So, Linda, given the life that you value now, given the way that you live that feels that it's worth it for you now, what were some of the experiences or that you had to have in order to know this is the life you need to live now?
Well, I would say probably the most profound experience happened to me 13 years ago. I have Crohn's disease. I lived with it for 10 years, and it was well controlled for about 8 years, and then I lived through 2 years of
agony.
Lots of pain and agony.
Imagine other words.
And then it got to the point where my son was getting ready to, my son is in the National Guard, and he was getting ready to deploy to Iraq. And every particle of my being said he couldn't go. He just could not go, that it would not, he would not come back alive. And I started getting incredibly sick to the point that I threw pulmonary emboli. I survived that, spent some time in the hospital, and then had three more hospitalizations for hemorrhaging and just severe dehydration, had five ICU admissions, received 11 units of blood. And finally, my local gastroenterologist came in, and he had scoped me for the last time. And he said, Linda, your colon is the worst I've seen in 30 years. It has got to come out or you're going to die. And that was it.
Yeah.
And as a nurse, I knew how sick I was.
That's what I was going to say. As a nurse, you have
I knew I was dying. I literally, every time I went into ICU, I didn't think I was coming back out. I mean, I knew that just the way I could see the looks that you're supposed to be hiding as a nurse, but when you're watching them, you can see them. And I knew every time that I started getting worse that they weren't sure I was going to make it. So on September 1st, I had my colon removed. I celebrate that day every year because it was my rebirth. It gave me a life that I now am free of lots of pain and being tied to a bathroom and being able to do all sorts of activities that I couldn't do before. It allows me to plan my life. But I went home after 8 days after the surgery, was home for 3 days, and was rushed back to the hospital in an ambulance, full sirens blaring. They didn't think I was going to make it to the hospital. I lapsed into a coma. I was septic. I was in the coma for a week. I coded twice while I was in the coma. They told my husband, go home and get her affairs in order. She's not going to make it through the night. And thanks to Cuba Medical Center and a lot of my former nursing students, I pulled through, came out of the coma, very confused, dazed, scared, could not move any part of my body except to hold my head up. Had to learn to sit up, had to learn to walk, had to learn to feed myself, had to learn to get back to normal life. Was housebound for a month, spent 4 months trying to close my incision because I was so malnourished that I had no protein to heal with.
Wow.
and finally was able to get back to work after being out of work for like 4 months. And you go through something like that and you realize that every day is precious and that you were given a gift. And if I didn't realize it up until that point, I realized it very well by that point. Mm-hmm. And so for me, truly every day is a gift. I wake up every morning and put my feet on the ground and say, yep, got another day to make a difference. This is a good day. I also decided at that point in time, it was time to get really healthy. I was very, very overweight. I was weighing in at over 325 pounds and that complicated my surgery and my recovery and the everything. And so I decided it was time to lose that weight. And so I have lost about 150 pounds and kept it off for over 8 years. So all of a sudden I have more energy, which is wonderful too. So it allows me to do more. To enjoy life even more.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Now, the crisis and what led up to it and then recovering from it, how is your life substantially different now than it was 20 years ago? But what's, if you could put 2 days next to each other, how would you describe the difference?
Well, I think 20 years ago, I was just going through each day, going through the motions, doing what I needed to. I raised 4 kids, was doing a full-time job, but I wasn't really that focused on what's going on around me. It was just an inward focus. And now it's just so critical for me to be aware of what's going on outside my own little house, my own little family, to my community, to my country, to the world, and to see what kinds of differences I can make in that whole process.
So in a certain sense, the making a difference began just 10 to 15 years ago. Profound joy.
Very deliberative. Yeah. Deliberative. Yeah. I think I was doing things before that, but not with a sense of purpose like I do now. And it's led me to things like to go way out of my level of comfort. One of the things that I've done is lobby both on Capitol Hill and in Albany. In my lifetime, I never would have considered. I mean, I've lobbied with a number of senators and mm-hmm. representatives on Capitol Hill to increase rights for people who live with ostomies like me. And in Albany, I partnered with 3 wound ostomy incontinent nurses and a lobbyist, and we actually got legislation passed in New York State mandating that all insurance companies that provide ostomy surgery also pay for the supplies that people need after the surgery. And again, in my lifetime, I never would have expected to do anything like that. Mm-hmm. Just the thought of something 20 years ago, that would have been so overwhelming to me that I never would have thought I could have done that or made a difference.
Right, right. So it's simplistic to say what's changed on some level is your resolve. But what about your resolve has changed? What is the good that you're grabbing for?
To feel like my surviving everything that I survived, there's a purpose for that. One of the things, when I was so sick in the hospital, I never really got into why is it happening to me. I kept thinking, there's a reason why this is happening.
And you're a problem solver and you're going to get through it.
I am a problem solver. I'm going to get through it. But also there was something I needed to learn from all of that as well. And one of the things that I did learn was to let others help me. And, I've always been, as a nurse, as a mom, as a, the way I was raised as a daughter, as a wife, always wanting to do things for others and never letting people do things for me. And that was something that I learned in that whole process, because I could not have gotten through everything I've gotten through without a lot of support. Mm-hmm. And then there was also the sense of, okay, I survived all these things and other people didn't. I knew 2 people personally around the same time that I threw my pulmonary embolus that died, mm-hmm. and they were my age. And there was a big question in my head, like, well, why did they die and why didn't I?
Right.
And what does this all mean? And that sense of purpose that I already had just became so much more magnified. Like, there's a reason why I'm here. I'm still here, that I've survived all this. One of it is that I became a mom again of a granddaughter. And I knew that was an answer to one of the questions. My husband and I are raising our granddaughter, Savannah, who is 10 now. And we've been full-time parents since she was 3. And that sort of pushed us into a retirement, a different vision of what our retirement was going to be. And that certainly was a very profound answer to my purpose for surviving.
Sure.
One of the... So...
Right. Yeah. And a reason... The reason or purpose for surviving can be to merely live consciously aware of what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you were living kind of, you didn't use the rat in the maze, but you were living for yourself.
Right.
And that's not aware. That's not being mindful.
Right.
Of
exactly.
What is around you and what can be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a purpose that we can discover at any time.
Right.
Whenever the light bulb goes off or the connection happens. When you were talking about, as a somewhat arrogant young pastor, I used to really put the kibosh on people helping other people if they hadn't first asked for help at some point in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, I felt like you really needed to have been there to be able to go there. So you got a lot of help.
Oh yes.
And
I
do
did.
You and how has that changed the way you can now ask for help and the way that you give it?
That's a really good question, one I hadn't really thought about, but I think one of the things that I've learned is to be sensitive about how to give help, because there is such a sense of dignity and worth in each person. And sometimes we can think we're being helpful and we can squash that.
Right.
And it's very important for me that I don't just assume that somebody needs or wants help when they may not be ready to handle it. And as far as my own self, I find it is easier. When I was in that, I would say my not mindful life when I was just working and taking care of my kids.
And I know you're saying it with tongue in cheek.
Yeah. Yeah. Being a full-time professional and raising 4 kids,
right,
who were very, very involved in stuff is more than 2 full-time jobs. But I think now it's easier to ask for help because I've learned that people want to do that. And you also can be helpful to them. They want to do something. And sometimes it's creating projects that they can get involved in. Sometimes it's asking directly for help, but not being afraid and not feeling like that's saying that I'm not strong enough, I can't do it. I think that's, for me, is something I've learned, that it's okay to say you can't do it all and you can't be it all.
Right, right. And receiving help is not a defect.
Mm-mm.
Giving help is not a superior
no.
position to be from. And we confuse help a lot with issues around charity,
mm-hmm.
and dependency. And one of the things that I go to often on the show is the notion of covenant. In a covenant relationship, I do for you what you cannot do for yourself, but need in order to thrive. I will not do what you can do for yourself. I will ask of you to do for me what I cannot do for myself, but I need in order to thrive. Mm-hmm. But if I ask, but I ought not ask you something I can really do for myself, because that's a waste of your good skills. And I'm not pulling my oar,
mm-hmm.
or pulling my
mm-hmm.
weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people are still noodling their problems and haven't figured out what it is they can ask for, then they can't be helped, because that interferes with them figuring it out.
Right.
On
right,
some level.
Right.
And then doing anything that they can do for themselves is just infantilizing or weakening them.
Exactly. Yeah,
and so we have to know each other really well,
mm-hmm.
in this, what I call a covenantal relationship, mm-hmm. which is how community really happens, because it's not
right.
organized. There's no roles and there are no rights.
That's
and
right.
There are no real rules when it comes to these kinds of relationships, because you discover what's possible as
mm-hmm.
you do it.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah.
Pardon me for preaching on a Sunday morning. Anyway,
it doesn't hurt us.
Yeah, yeah. But what you described as having learned is very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. And being clear about what it is we're doing, we're asking for what we can't do for ourselves, and we're offering what others can't do for them. And we sometimes aren't clear or honest about what we can or cannot do for ourselves. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And other people may not be clear or honest about mm-hmm. what they can. So it's a process sometimes of conflict.
Well, and I think sometimes if you can show yourself as needing help, you can role model that for other people, mm-hmm. give them a safe space to say, wow, if she needs some help, maybe it's okay for me to ask in a different area.
Right.
And I think that's one of the other things that I've learned is to be open and vulnerable. And, you know, living with an ostomy, I have lots and lots of, you know, there's over a million of us in this country mm-hmm. that are living with one. And one of the things that I've done is to be very, very open about it. Mm-hmm. And because I've talked to people who have family members, relatives, friends, or whatever, who are so terrified of the surgery that they will choose to literally die from mm-hmm. a cancer that could be cured by having the surgery.
Right.
Because they can't handle the thought of living with a surgery. So I've been, you know, I'm very out there. I tell everybody. And it's that creating that vulnerable space that allows other people to say, well, maybe it is safe. And so people will say, will you talk to a friend of mine? Or will you email somebody? Or will you whatever? To let them know that, you know, it's not a weakness. Mm-hmm. It's not a life sentence. It's, you know, it's a freeing in so mm-hmm. many ways.
Right.
And life is too precious to not choose life.
My uncle had an ostomy in 1971 or two and mm-hmm. had it for 40 years when mm-hmm. he died in his mid-80s.
Great. So it gave him some
great life. It gave him a lot of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
It gave him a lot of life. And there was shame and silence about it initially, mm-hmm. and it took a while. But there was also a lot of fear because his mother and my mother's mother, my grandmother, died after having, in the 1930s, after 4 or 5 years of being bedridden with cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was just an arduous process that dragged everybody in the family down.
Yeah, it is so scary.
Anyway, the fear button made him do it,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but it also helped him become more out front about it as an executive for a major seed industry in the U.S.
Wonderful.
So let's cut to music. What would you like to play next?
Let's do Happy.
Ah.
Let's be happy.
good. And we don't need to say anything more than just play it.
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say. Sunshine, she's here, you can take a break. I'm a hot air balloon that could go to space. With the air, like I don't care, baby, by the way. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room with
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Linda Pasto. And I want to just tell the listener that you could have watched her bouncing and dancing here. And, I mean, it's just like, you know, she's moving her arms. She's her body's moving up and down. And she's being happy. And I guess, so what we were talking about while you were listening to the music and we were off air was... How is it that you bring happiness to other people who've had an ostomy, and how what have you had to do to try to show them that this is a really viable and good life mm-hmm. and enjoy it?
Well, one of the things I've done is, again, get out of my level of comfort, and I've appeared in several videos that are used with patients who are either facing the surgery or have just had the surgery. And the funny part of that all is they've all been filmed locally. They've been filmed at the local parks and YMCA, and I've always been in a bathing suit. And I told all of my friends that if they ever took a picture of me in a bathing suit, I was going to break the camera. But I decided to get over myself because I figured if I could get somebody into the water, over their fear that life was never going to be the same again, I had to show them by doing it. And so that's one of the things I've done. And I've also made hospital visits. I've made visits to people in coffee shops. I've made visits to people in their homes who are struggling with it. I met with one lady who, she was an older lady, and she was going on vacation with her family, and she relatively new ostomy patient, and was terrified that her appliance was going to come off if she went in the ocean, and how awful it would be if her, you know, if it came off in the water. And I finally looked at her. We made a pact, but I the first thing I said to her before we made the pact was, you know, whales poop in the ocean, so it's okay if it happens. And she laughed, which was important. Humor is very important. And we made a pact that she would at least sit with the ocean water up to her waist. And she came back after a week after we met and said that she went swimming every day. And it freed her, and she felt like she was a whole new person. So being very open, being very honest, using humor, talking about life experiences. I always tell people some of my worst case scenarios of when my ostomy appliance failed me. Like, one of the worst for me was I was in a pub in England, and the bathroom was way in the back of the pub. And as I was pulling my clothes off to go to the bathroom, something caught and everything spilled everywhere. And so there I was in the back of this very crowded pub, and there was toilet paper that was kind of the consistency of wax paper. So it was not a good situation. And I kind of looked at myself, and I really wanted to sit down on the floor and just cry, but that wasn't going to get me anywhere. So as they say, I pulled up my big girl pants, walked through the tavern, caught my husband's eye and said, I need some help. And we went out to the bus and got clean clothes, and I got cleaned up and just went on the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. And so I always talk with people when I'm meeting with them and say, okay, so what's your worst case scenario? And with my lady in the ocean, it was that her appliance would come off in the ocean. I said, so let's walk through what you do. Mm-hmm. And that has helped a lot of people, I think. Just let's talk about your biggest fears, either before surgery or after surgery. Sometimes just looking at things are, you know, that your body that looks different is a scary thing. So I do that with them. Let's look, let's do it together. I'd never seen an ostomy before I had my own. Even as a nurse, I'd never had a patient with an ostomy. So that was a huge life-changing experience for me. Mm-hmm. And now it's just part of the everyday life. My grandkids think it's pretty cool that grandma poops differently than everybody else does. They find it fascinating.
Yes, I'm sure they will for a few years. One of the things about, you know, you have found a place of hope and trust, a place of faith with which to live with your ostomy. The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is despair. Mm-hmm. And what you have just shown by giving people ways to think through their worst case or to live with you through your worst case scenario is that, you know, I can be hopeful and trusting because I may not have a good answer, but I can approach this. I may not get what I really want here, but I will get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tremendous gift in the face of despair, because it's despair that keeps us from trying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we don't, there's a saying in the Buddhist community that hope is toxic. Well, if you hope for something that's specific, that is toxic.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are open to whatever you can do and just figure it out in the moment, and it's not going to be perfect, it's not going to be even necessarily what you wanted, but, you know, it's something. And that's enough.
It's certainly better than the alternative.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, it's a matter of trying to find joy in every day.
Well, yeah. And so how do you snag joy in this? How do you look for joy every day?
Well, some days it's harder than others. There are some days, well, I will be completely honest, that I wish that I didn't have to live with what I have to live with.
Mm-hmm.
I not only live with the ostomy, but as a result of the pulmonary emboli, I have some heart and lung damage that was done that comes with surviving that. So I live with that as well. And I live with joint issues that comes from having carried around all that extra weight for all those years. But that's just what it is. I mean, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of focusing on it and saying, okay, I can't do this because I have all these problems, I focus on, well, let's focus on what I can do.
Right.
And let's not get caught up. Because I meet and talk with a lot of people who start giving me all the reasons why they can't do certain things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've tried to take can't out of my vocabulary, because it is something that brings you down to despair, and it brings you down, and, you know, it limits you so much that your world starts closing in around you, and you stop wanting to take risks and wanting to find joy in the things that you can do.
Sure. Sure. No, that, I get it. So how have you had to change the person you were? I'm not talking about the events that you reacted to, that you found a way to kind of come out better. What did you have to choose to say, you know, I've got to handle this differently because the way I did it in the past is not working for me anymore?
One of the biggest things I've learned, and my family, I think, will back me up on this, is I've learned to be much more patient. I was a pretty type A, very time-sensitive, pushy, commanding mm-hmm. kind of person. That's, you know, those are some of my strengths that have gotten me through a lot of adversity in my life.
And they can certainly leave a wake of destruction.
That's right. And certainly as a nurse, they've been good things to, yeah. you know, to, I've been a manager, you know, I've been an educator. They were all good things that worked then, but they don't work well when your body's healing and your life has changed. And so I've had to really learn to take a good deep breath, slow down, count to 10 or 20 or 100, and refocus sometimes and really be patient and let things happen instead of always trying to take control, because things were out of control for so long. And I had to, you know, I had to learn to slow down. And that has been probably the biggest change for me
mm-hmm.
That I am very aware of, that, you know, I can't always be the one that's in control. I got to let other people take the reins.
So is it a choice for patience, or is it an acceptance of not being in control? I mean, is it more one or the other? I imagine it's some, yeah.
Well, no, I think it's patience. I think it's patience because, you know, that allows other people to sort of work through whatever we're trying to work through. And sometimes it still leaves me having to take control, but it allows things to evolve the way they should evolve instead of me just jumping in and saying, okay, this is the way we're going to do it, and we're going to do it now. Taking a step back and that allows each person to be heard, each person to be valued. I've found this in my professional life mm-hmm. when I was working with a group of incredible colleagues at TC3, that one of the ways I learned patience is I picked up knitting and crocheting during meetings, and it would force me to focus on what I was doing and listen to the conversations and take a step back and allow everybody in the room to be heard rather than I know what needs to happen and I'm going to tell you exactly what needs to happen. It forced me to be patient and allow them to all be part of the whole process. Mm-hmm. And I also did that with my family. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was a really good lesson, because when I was a patient in the hospital, I had to be incredibly patient because sometimes the nurse wasn't there when I wanted her, or I couldn't do something that one day that I knew 5 days down the road I might get to, but I had to just wait and let things evolve. And that's really hard for someone who's used to being in charge all the time mm-hmm, and being mm-hmm. on the other end, being in charge versus being the one that's receiving. So I would say patience is definitely probably one of the biggest changes in my life.
Mm-hmm. And with the patience, and that's that is what you choose when you can't necessarily control in the moment. Mm-hmm. You can also observe more deeply.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And be mindful in ways that you wouldn't have been mindful. And it's funny how a counterbalancing activity can allow you to be more, the knitting can allow you to be more present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It took me a long time to realize that when my partner's knitting, that she can be present.
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah.
Because it's a distracting activity that mm-hmm. allows, you know,
so it's also meditative yeah. in some ways, and it really allows, you know, I used to try to sit on my hands so I wouldn't talk. I don't know why I thought that was going to work.
Because you talk with your hands.
Because I talk with my hands, it's true, as I'm doing right now. And I used to try that in a meeting, and that didn't work. So I had to keep my hands busy, and then that really focused.
Yeah.
And you learn to really respect all the voices that you hear in that patience process. And it certainly worked as well in the variety of community groups that I'm involved in now, that, you know, that's allowed me to be, I think, a much more meaningful member of different groups mm-hmm, and really know when I need to step in and know when I need to just sit back and listen.
Mm-hmm. You're making me remember, I was sitting across from a man who was nearly 100 years old, about, you know, 15, 17 years ago. And he was sitting with his hands kind of in his lap, but all fingers touching the corresponding finger and thumb, which is a traditional meditative pose. Mm-hmm. But it's also the way that I remember seeing the old men sit on the town I grew up in. I grew up in a town in Missouri where when I was born in 1958, the average age in that town was about 65.
Wow.
So lots of old mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. And the old men would sit on benches when the weather was good, and they would sit with their fingers like this, and they would just very intermittently talk with each other. And they would behold mm-hmm. you. They would look at you. It would kind of, and it wasn't just cataracts. It was they would just have this wide-eyed taking you in. And that's, we are so on agendas and stuff. Our eyes are too focused. We're not seeing mm-hmm. peripherally enough. We're not mm-hmm. just beholding stuff. And that whenever I need to slow down, I rediscovered that when he sat that way. And then I started to go back and practice it intentionally.
Wow, what
because
a great
it's
gift.
Just, it was a gift back.
Yeah, that's a great
same
gift.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the groups that you work with now, you're raising a 10-year-old mm-hmm. grandchild,
mm-hmm.
And
have four other wonderful grandchildren as well.
And life is, I imagine, quite full.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
So, what is it like being a parent the second time around? That's different than the first time around.
Well, it's been very interesting to have you. We're literally straddling two different generations. We're straddling the generation of our kids who, you know, the parents of my granddaughter's contemporaries are our kids' age.
Right.
And then we still have very strong connections with our own group of friends who are retiring, most of them heading south for the winter, leaving us up here in the cold. And so you have to negotiate relationships with two different generations mm-hmm. who definitely think differently. It's different in that our poor granddaughter, we've already raised four kids, and sometimes she'll start doing something, and I look at her and I say, honey, we've been through this already four times before, and it's not going to fly anymore this time than it did the other four times.
But it's 2019.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's certainly, you know, with her, things are certainly different. The technology is, mm-hmm. you know, much more intense, and, you know, we're dealing with all sorts of issues that we didn't have to deal with our four kids even 20 years ago.
Sure.
But we also have the time to just focus on her, mm-hmm. which is different than we did. Because when we were raising our kids, we were both very, very intense in the peak of our careers.
Sure.
And so now it's just the volunteer activities that we're doing, which certainly we can be flexible about. So it is a very different kind of experience, and it allows us to be more present with her, mm-hmm. which is something that I really enjoy. I retired when she started kindergarten because that just felt like the right thing to do. You know, we are the parents and the grandparents. The energy is not there as much, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and that's certainly a difference for us that we have to, you know, we have to try to find more energy. But sometimes it's like, oh, I don't know if I can do this, but I have to because this is the first time she's done it.
Right.
This is her first time through, even though I've already done it four times already. It's the first time for her, and it's new, and it's fresh, and it's exciting. So, yes, I have to go to that parent conference and sit on those little chairs, and I have to be really excited about that big project that she brings home, or, you know, her first Girl Scout overnight or whatever it is that we're doing. Yes, I go and sleep in tents on the ground with the Girl Scouts still because I did it for the others, so I've got to do it for her.
Right.
So,
And you're using I've got to do it, but it doesn't sound like an obligation as much as it sounds like, you know, this is your love.
Oh, absolutely. It brings me such joy to be present with her friends, with her parents. My husband and I are respite for, you know, sometimes for, you know, some of her friends' parents,
yeah.
You know, helping them out because they're doing what we were doing with our four kids.
Right.
And so we're home all the time. So, yeah, if there's a snow day, yeah, we'll take your kid for the day. Or if there's a school delay, sure, we'll take them so you can get them on the bus. Or if, you know, somebody ends up needing an emergency, whatever, sure, we can do all that because we're part of that community. We're helping raise those kids just like we did with our four kids. So that piece isn't different. It's just we can give more this time.
And 100 years ago, it would have been normative.
Yes.
And in a few years from now, it may well be normative again because we will rely on these informal and family relationships mm-hmm. more because our institutions are not capable of carrying through for us.
Exactly.
Right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right now.
Exactly.
What would you like to play for music next?
Oh, let's do Tub Thumpin'.
Do you want to say anything about it?
No, it makes me dance. So.
Okay, here we go.
that song makes me dance.
Yeah. Yes, I get knocked down, but I get up again.
Absolutely.
And actually, this is a direct lead in to the next question. What do you do to take care of yourself?
That's a great question.
And I mean this physically and emotionally and intellectually, which to me add up to spiritually. And throughout the day, weekly, monthly, you know, what do you do and how do you know you need to do it?
Sure. Well, one of the things I do every day without fail is I work out for an hour every day. I do a good hard workout at the local Jazzercise studio. And I do that without fail unless I'm traveling and then I find something else to do. But 365 days a year, I'm there if I'm home, if right. I'm not traveling. And traveling is another way that I, you know, rejuvenate. Sometimes I travel by myself, on girls' trips without my husband and my granddaughter. Sometimes yeah. we go. Uh-huh. That's always a challenge, the travel with the ostomy. But haven't let it stop me and have done all sorts of zip lining and, you know, snorkeling and all sorts of fun. We've been to the Far East. I've been to 5 out of the 7 continents. I hope to get to Africa at some point in time. I'm not so sure about Antarctica, but love to travel. And that brings me great joy, just meeting different people and exploring cultures. I do a lot of activities that, have coffee with friends, and I'm involved in Rotary, and I enjoy that a lot. I enjoy doing service a lot, involved with Food Net, involved with Hospice Care, mm-hmm. love living at home, Girl Scouts. All those things bring me joy and give me a chance to kind of rejuvenate
sure.
for various reasons.
So those are the emotional, relational, heart connections.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that takes you out in the world
mm-hmm. Every day.
Right. And so you're making those heart, you have your family, but you're making those heart connections also
right.
well outside your home. What about taking care of your mind?
Well,
and kind of keeping your, I mean, they come sometimes in yeah. the same bundles, but yeah.
Well, when I try to escape every night for about an hour, I curl up, go upstairs to the bedroom, shut the door, me and the dogs, and do some reading.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows me to kind of, you know, just pull away from the world mm-hmm. and just have my quiet space. And my husband's great with supporting that. He's usually doing homework with Savannah, getting her ready for bed.
Uh-huh.
And I just have my quiet time, and that kind of rejuvenates me. Sometimes if I'm home during the day, I can do it during
sure.
the day, but I usually try to get an hour every day that's my time that I can do nothing, other than maybe just try to quiet my mind a little bit.
Right.
And sometimes it's reading and sometimes it's listening to something, some music or whatever, mm-hmm. but, you know, that quiet time.
What type of reading do you enjoy?
Fantasy.
Uh-huh.
I really love fantasy, like, you know, Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter and that kind of genre.
Sure,
I love that kind of reading.
Entire universes and multi-volume.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But usually things that have a relatively happy ending. I don't want to read a really sad book because life's hard and
right.
I don't, you know, I prefer the happier kinds of things.
Right. And this is to keep your mind going, but not necessarily to make it work through suffering or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, I read, you know, I still keep involved in my profession somewhat, and I've done some professional presentations since I've retired. But, so I try to do a little bit of that as well. And, you know, to still keep the professional brain cells going.
Right. And when you teach nursing at a community college, it's very likely you're going to run into a lot of your old former students.
Oh, all the time.
So what is that like for you?
Oh, I get such joy. I've always gotten such joy from my students, and to see them out in the community, I have regular contact with a whole variety of them, mostly through Facebook. We keep mm-hmm. in touch, but then I'll see them out in the community. My kids always moan and groan because every time they go anywhere, if they have contact with a nurse, the first question is, are you related to Linda Pastow? They just kind of roll their eyes and say, yes.
How did you know?
Yeah. But to see them know, having watched them struggle through through nursing school, because a lot of them are single moms trying to keep their life together, going through school, and to see them out working professionally and not just surviving, but thriving mm-hmm. and growing, and their whole, it's changed their whole life. And it's so exciting to see that. And they want to tell me, they want to tell me their stories. And I remember stories about them. I'm not real good with names, but I often remember stories about them because I love to tell stories. That's how I taught, was right. through stories. Right. And so,
and they want your blessing.
They do. They do. Yeah. They, some of them yelled at me when I was so sick that 13 years ago. And that was one of the hardest things for me to hear, because usually it's great joy when I see them. But a number of them took care of me when I was in the coma, and they yelled at me afterwards. And they said, "Don't you ever do that to us again." And I was like, "What did I do?" And they said, "We were terrified that you were going to die on our shift."
Right.
And we could never have lived with it. And then you realize how much of a profound right. effect you've had on their lives, that, you know, that that fear of that response. And I said, "But it wouldn't have been your fault." And they said, "But we never would have ever forgotten it."
Right. And in a certain sense, it's also a challenge to your self-care mm-hmm. that led up to that situation. Not that it's causal, mm-mm. but the stress of your son mm-hmm. going away, mm-hmm. the fact that you couldn't bear the thought of him dying and you couldn't right. believe he'd make it back. All of those things just impact the system so powerfully. How was your self-care prior to the incident compared to your self-care now?
Night and day.
So what changed?
Night and day. And I do want to say one little caveat sure. to the story. He did not go to Iraq.
Right.
When I was dying, his commanding officer, he was volunteering to go.
Right.
And his commanding officer allowed him to rescind
his
offer to go. And so he did not go. And so in some ways, I feel like I saved his life, you know, and that's a pretty profound thing, mm-hmm. you know, because sure. I had no doubt that that was what was going to happen. But my self-care before that was not good at all. I definitely was not taking care of myself. I wasn't eating well. I wasn't exercising. I was profoundly overweight. I was just taking care of my family and not taking care of me. I wasn't really listening to my body at mm-hmm. all, mm-hmm. which was telling me, you know, I'm in stress. I'm in crisis. You've got to do something. And I just said, "Tomorrow, I'll do it tomorrow. I, you know, I'm not mm-hmm. going to take care of you today. I've got too much else to do. I've right. got to keep this job going. I've got to keep this family going." And I realized afterwards, if I didn't, it's kind of like the old adage that they say on the airlines, you put the oxygen on yourself first.
Right.
If I didn't take care of myself and keep myself going, a lot of other things were going to fall apart, and
right.
I needed to do that. So I'm very much more aware of that now, and realize sometimes when I'm having a tough patch that I need to do something more. So maybe it's, you know, doing a getaway with some friends, or mm-hmm. just taking some time, you know, taking myself out to lunch, or going for a walk with a friend, or, you know, right. doing something right. for me.
Were you able to process that quickly enough for it to change the way you taught nursing?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, because you had been teaching nurses by a not so great example,
mm-hmm.
and then you got the memo,
mm-hmm.
and you changed. How did your teaching change?
Well, one of the things I wanted the students to understand, I always knew as a nurse what a difference I made in patients' lives, or I always thought I knew as a nurse mm-hmm. the difference I made until I really became a patient. And then it was so profound. I realized how much of a difference we make in a patient's life. There I was laying in that bed, scared to death. I was sure that I wasn't going to make it. And I had so many people hold my hand and talk to me and mm-hmm. reassure me. And it wasn't even, you know, a big thing that anybody was doing, but it was the way they approached me, it was the way they talked to me, it was their soothing tone of voice, it was letting me know that they cared. You know, one of the most profound for me was the day I had the colon out, and I was going under anesthesia, and I was convinced I was not going to wake up. Mm-hmm. I was sure I was going to die on the operating table. And one of my former students was in the operating room, and she came over, she talked to me, she held my hand, and I locked eyes on her eyes as I went under anesthesia. And I knew, because she was in the OR, that I was going to make it through. Okay. And she, I told her that in the cafeteria at the hospital a couple years later, and she immediately burst into tears and started crying. She said, "You know, as an OR nurse, I never get a chance to hear those kinds of stories. And she
knows
said,
to make the contact.
Yeah. And she said, you have no idea what kind of a difference that made for me. So I used my story with my students, but I didn't tell them it was my story. I told, I used it as a case study, and they would say, oh my gosh, how did this poor woman ever survive? And how could she go? And I'm trying hard not to grin and not to say anything, but we'd work through the case study. And then finally at the end, I would disclose to them that it was my story. And I said, and I hope that you will get from this story a sense of hope for your patients, a sense of joy, a sense of purpose. And I want you to know how much of a difference you as a nursing student and as a nurse can make in someone's life, because I experienced it. And it really increased my sense of who I was as a professional, and the differences that I could make.
Linda, it has been wonderful to get to know you. And we're going to close with what is your and your husband's favorite
song. Yeah. He plays it for me all the time.
And you want to announce it?
It's Still the One by Orleans.
And thank you very much for doing this.
And thank you for having me.
Still having fun, and you're still